Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, just enjoying a slice of cake. Now, if you like the idea of getting into our cabinet room, sadly there will be no refreshments available, you want to come on and play our hugely popular quiz, Can You Get to Number 10? 10 general knowledge questions loosely connected to 10 cabinet jobs. The more questions you get right, the better job you get, taking your place alongside our listeners and guests. If you make it all the way to number 10 and get that right, you'll become our show's Prime Minister. And now, everyone who gets in the cabinet gets a certificate. So if you want to do that, email me now, matt.chorley@times.radio, and we'll get you on the radio and you get yourself a certificate. Who doesn't like a certificate? If you also want to come and see me live, I'm on tour from February the 8th, going all around the country, England, Wales, Scotland, all over the place. If you want to come and see me trying to answer the question, who is in charge here? It's not totally clear what the answer to that is going to be. Then you can find details at mattchorley.com. Right, that's enough housekeeping. Coming up on today's episode, as Liz Truss tries to untangle the disputes over Northern Ireland and the Brexit deal, we ask, are we heading for a united Ireland? Polls suggest people in both Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland think that's where we're heading. So we're going to unpick that in our big thing. But first, as ever, we kick off with our columnist panel. And it's Tuesday, so it must be Finger Rich.
Meet the Cerberus of columnists. The Janus of journalism. And the ultimate political portmanteau of opinion. Finkelvich, with Daniel Finkelstein and David Aronovich on Times Radio.
Why is it that the words interior designer always make me laugh?
It is so funny.
I mean, it is, but cake, wife, interior designer together, and it's almost like you have an episode of Absolutely Fabulous, isn't it, or something like it. It's Jennifer Saunders falling drunk out of a taxi.
Well, talking of interior design, we can see your office there. You've got a cushion on your sofa. What does it say on the cushion?
It says a woman's place is in the White House.
Very good. Very good. And what's that thrown over the back of your sofa?
That is the national flag of Albania.
Is this the work of Lulu Little?
It is. I asked her, can you give me something which is kind of eccentric, but somehow kind of falsely intellectual? And she said, no problem at all. I've done work for Boris Johnson.
And that pile of sort of, what is that? Is that your gym kit? Dirty washing? What's that on the sofa? Is that all part of the installation?
No. It's not actually. It's part of lockdown stuff that, elastic, those bands you use for exercise and all that kind of stuff, which in lockdown we all had to do, kind of for Zoom Pilates sessions. It's all that kind of stuff. And I don't know what to do with it because I'm worried if I throw it away, then we'll get locked down again. And so actually, you shouldn't throw it away. You should, but then what I realise is I should have a party with it.
That's what you should do.
Kind of a lockdown Pilates party.
That's the sort of thing you want to go to, Danny. Let's talk about, we're not going to talk about parties. What I want to, I think, Danny, you suggested this. One of the arguments put forward by the Tory MPs who are trying to defend the Prime Minister right now, I think James Gray was making this point in the FT today, is that with everything going on in the world, with Ukraine and Russia and so on, now would be a terrible time to remove Boris Johnson.
Yes, it's the usual argument about having leadership elections is this is a terrible time. So it's too close to the last election and the Prime Minister still has a mandate. It's too close to the next election, which means if we change the law, change the leader, there'll be an election. Or we shouldn't do it now because if we do it now, there'll be an election. The other variant of it, which isn't electoral, is this is a moment of crisis. It's the same thing, by the way, when people go on holiday, when Prime Ministers go on holiday. Every year there's something that means they should be back. And the reason for that is that if you're the Prime Minister, things happen all the time. So this it doesn't seem to me a particularly strong argument that we should continue with crisis-ridden leadership we don't trust, because we might need that crisis-ridden leadership we don't trust to fight a war. And in previous occasions, we've done it in the middle of these things, as we did indeed with the Gulf War, for example. That's exactly when Margaret Thatcher fell.
And that's the point, isn't it? The Margaret Thatcher went and John Major took over precisely while Iraq was erupting.
And sometimes, by the way, you know, as indeed was the case with Theresa May's resignation, it was necessary because of the big issue. But in other cases, it's just secondary to it. You know, a lot of things in politics, it's not the perfect moment, because there isn't such a thing as the perfect moment. It just is the moment. So, of course, it would be better if this didn't coincide with all sorts of other big issues, but it just does, and there's nothing to be done about it.
I suppose, what do you think, Dave? Is there ever a good time to change leaders?
Well, I presume that the same people are not saying, actually, we should have done it a month ago. That would have been a better time. And we're remiss in not having had a leadership election a month ago. But now we've waited too long. It's a particularly bad time. In other words, Dan is absolutely right. It's just a kind of cover for we don't want a leadership election because we're dependent upon Boris Johnson. Or at least we've got to say we don't want a leadership election until there is one, at which point we all stand for it. Or we all declare candidates and we'll declare ourselves incredibly happy that our candidate would actually make a very good job of this situation. And Dan is completely right. I mean, there is a very, very big argument for really just getting on with this leadership election, for getting rid of Boris Johnson. I mean, what you could say is trust in him is so scant now that we almost any significant figure in the Conservative Party would actually have more respect than Boris Johnson would have, and therefore that's a very good reason for getting on and doing it. You just have to do it fairly quickly, that's all. I mean, with a kind of degree of rapidity. Well, I mean, that would have been an argument for keeping the old MP system, because that was a very quick system. I like the DUP system, where they only have about 14 people get to vote. And it's not actually, I don't really like it, but at least it provided.
But they do have the advantage of there not being very many of them. Danny, Kevin's been in touch saying, should Winston Churchill have waited till the end of World War II before launching his leadership bid?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was a bit like the other one that I mentioned, the Theresa May one. It was caused by the big issue.
Yeah.
But clearly, having the ability to have new leadership can sometimes be a big advantage in crisis as well as a big disadvantage. Yeah. The crucial point to understand is there's never a moment when the Prime Minister's not doing anything, where it's not, you know, if, for example, this had happened a year ago, you could have said, well, we can't change the Prime Minister because we're in the middle of the COVID crisis.
Yeah.
And as I say, in a year's time, you could be saying, well, we can't change the Prime Minister, we're in the middle of a cost of living crisis. There's always a big challenge. Otherwise, you wouldn't need to bother thinking about who the Prime Minister was, because it wouldn't matter that much. The reason it matters that much is because there are these constant issues. And of course, it's better if that there's a sort of moment of total calm when you're making these decisions. But probably if there was a moment of total calm, you wouldn't bother with it because everything would be calm.
Well, exactly. We're in the middle of a prime minister legitimacy crisis. That's the crisis we're also in the middle of. And until you solve that, it's quite difficult to really take on the other crises.
I think it's very important to understand, because several people have said, and I've had to think about it, because I shouldn't just automatically dismiss it. You know, we shouldn't be going on and on about effectively a birthday cake and we've got all these big crises. The reason why things like the birthday cake matter and they've been given the prominence they have is because these huge issues require trustworthiness, integrity, a confidence that Downing Street will follow the law, a belief that the right people are being employed on the Prime Minister's staff. It's because of the big issues that these things matter. Of course, a cake isn't the issue. The issue is whether or not Prime Ministers need to follow the rules that they set. And of course, that matters in the case of Ukraine. What are we doing in the issue with Putin? We're disputing about liberal democratic norms and how broadly they should follow. Why would we bother doing that if we ignore the question of liberal democratic norms in our own country? So it isn't right to say all these parties are such a trivial issue compared to Ukraine. They're all part of the same thing, which is the preservation of liberal democratic norms.
There's also, David, an element of, with the Russia-Ukraine, Britain isn't doing anything. I mean, we're putting out statements saying we're very cross about it, but nobody really thinks that Britain, you know, unless you buy into the idea that Britain is one of the great military powers in the world and we're going to go and stand up to people, you know, we're going to launch a counter-invasion. That's not happening, is it? This idea of Britain being one of the, you know, joint policemen with America, that's not, you know, Boris Johnson's not playing a part in it anyway. It's not like he's got Britain's Putin on the phone, on the speed dial.
Yeah, Britain's not a joint policeman, Matt, but actually I do think that the position that Britain takes up is important, and not just because I'm a Brit. I don't say it's the most important or anything like that, but it's as important as the position taken up by France and Germany, and those are important positions to be taken up. And I do think they're important matters of policy, and our diplomacy is part of the diplomatic package, and what we do and what we advise and what we jointly discuss is of actually real significance. And that's what makes me worried about the current situation, is really how can somebody like Boris Johnson undistractedly deal with a crisis like this? It's a very big argument for a rapid leadership change. And the problem which is being put in our way over this is the idea that you can't do it rapidly. You can only do it slowly, and therefore you're going to have a period of when no one can do anything, of stasis, really. Matt, although I don't like that kind of business of saying, you know, that kind of boosterism, we're the biggest in the world, we're the best in the world, and so on, I do think we have some importance.
Well, we'll see how we'll see what happens. As Steve Swinford, Times' political editor, has just reported, Sue Gray is now expected to wait until the police carry out their investigations before publishing a report. There's concern that publishing the report would effectively prejudge the police investigation.
Which is why the Tory party should act now, by the way. I mean, if they possibly could, but they won't. But that's why they should actually go quick. The whole business of waiting for the Sue Gray report is a disaster for them. It's an absolute disaster. It's bad for the country, but it's really bad for them.
So we've gone from wait for Sue Gray to wait for the police to wait for Sue Gray. And that's going to go on for even longer, Danny.
It will. Yeah, I think this is that's a very regrettable decision. But the whole thing of waiting for Sue Gray was, in any case, a tactic. It seems to me that there's a great degree of clarity over the fact that the Prime Minister was attending a party that wasn't a work event in his own garden. There's a great degree of clarity over the fact that wasn't within the regulations. And there's a great deal of clarity that Downing Street held a large number of events, each of which were held by the Prime Minister's staff, for whom he is accountable and responsible. So we know the crucial things. What she will rule on will give us a bit more detail. It may give us a little bit of sharpness on questions of rules, but I think we know the basic facts, and it's debilitating to wait further. I should point out that the people have been putting huge pressure on the Metropolitan Police to do what Cressida Dick has now announced, and they'll now be furious that she's doing it. I've always been a bit uncomfortable about the operational decisions of the police being intervened in this way. We've now got ourselves into a tangle which was actually entirely predictable.
Let's move on.
Can we also now say, Danny, that there's also clarity about Boris Johnson having misled Parliament on this issue?
Yeah, I do think so, yes. I don't think the birthday gathering, I think whether it was a party is irrelevant. The birthday gathering, which was not within the not at all within the rules, that I don't think that changes whether or not he told the truth to Parliament. But I just think it's obvious that he did understand that it was a part, that it was a social event to which he was going to in the garden, and I just have never really believed that particular suggestion.
Well, let's just turn our attention, because people are getting in touch saying, "Why are you talking about cake?" Let's talk about somebody who has resigned. With some drama, Lord Agnew, who I don't need to tell you, was a Treasury and Cabinet Office Minister. This is what he did yesterday.
Schoolboy errors were made, for example, allowing over 1,000 companies to receive bounce-back loans that were not even trading when COVID struck. I've been arguing with Treasury and BEIS officials for nearly 2 years to get them to lift their game. I have been mostly unsuccessful. It is my deeply held conviction that the current state of affairs is not acceptable. Given that I'm the Minister for Counter-Fraud, it feels somewhat dishonest to stay on in that role if I'm incapable of doing it properly, let alone defending our track record. It is for this reason that I've sadly decided to tender my resignation as a Minister across the Treasury and Cabinet Office with immediate effect.
It was quite a moment, Danny. Do you know Theo Agnew?
I do, yes, because he was a trustee of Policy Exchange, the think tank, and I was its chairman. I think very highly of him. And indeed, there was a moment when his name came into the frame and people said, "Oh, Tories have appointed a donor to do this job." And I said, "No, I think he's a person of great integrity and force in my experience. Also, not much patience with people being incompetent. So I'm not entirely, this is quite in character. But he's a person who I think has a deep sense of right and wrong. And I think it frustrated him greatly that he couldn't get people to take action, that he was being given sort of political answers, because he's not a politician. It's an interesting thing, this. I wonder what David thinks. I think Theo Agnew's appointment is a bit of a justification for putting people in who are not just merely politicians. Probably a politician would have put up with this. And you've got two things, a plus and a minus. The plus is the politician probably wouldn't have resigned. They'd have carried on trying to do the job. And we've now lost a very effective person because he got fed up with it. But on the other side of it, by bringing Theo Agnew into the government, we got somebody who didn't just fall for being given political soft soap, who was a bit tougher than that. So I think it did show the value. People have questioned, I think, sometimes these bringing people in from outside. I'm not in favour of the idea that we had a businessman running the country, but I do think some of that experience is helpful in government, and he's probably demonstrated that. He's put up with less of what I think a politician probably would put up with.
It is an extraordinary moment, and we talked a lot about this on the show last week, David. £4.3 billion it was of fraud that was just being written off. In his resignation letter, Lord Agnew said, "Last week, a foolish decision was made to kill off the prospect of an economic crime bill in the third session. This would have enhanced our ability to tackle fraud with further savings of taxpayers' money. If my departure stimulates debate in these areas, leading to coordinated action, it would have been a good day's work."
That was hopeful, wasn't it, on his part? given everything else that's going on, I have to confess, I'd never heard of this chap before he resigned. Obviously, from what Danny's been saying, I should have done. I certainly don't take a theological view about whether or not you bring in outside expertise to be ministers via a second chamber, even if I don't like the way in which the second chamber is composed, and even if the value of it is enormously diminished by the sheer number of people who are in it at the moment, despite all his own pleas that it be slimmed down. Then I think it would be consistent with that position if at least 200 peers were to voluntarily say, well, actually, we shouldn't be peers and we're not doing very much and we should go away now. And that would certainly help my confidence in somebody like Lord Agnew being appointed to the job he's being appointed, because that would give me confidence it wasn't a reward to some kind of place person, because frankly, the appointments to the House of Lords in the course of the last couple of years are beyond disgraceful, some of them.
Daniel Finkelstein and David Aronovich there, and of course you can read them both in the Times every week. Just get yourself a digital subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timespentpod. Up next, are we heading for United Ireland?
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
You're listening to the Red Box podcast now. It's time for this. What should we make of this?
I'm absolutely determined to protect political stability and peace in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, that was the Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, speaking yesterday after the latest fruitless talks in Brussels on trying to solve the dispute over the treatment of Northern Ireland in post-Brexit rules. Since the UK left the EU, Northern Ireland has seen a rise in parliamentary violence, including a particularly bad spell in April last year, which saw 90 officers hurt. At the time, unionist leaders linked the violence to simmering loyalist tensions over the Irish Sea border imposed as a result of Brexit. But as the sea border and the ongoing lack of solutions mean that the island of Ireland is moving closer to becoming united. In this half hour, we'll speak to MPs from both the DUP and Sinn Féin and the author of a new book who looks into whether a united Ireland is now inevitable. But first, let's get the latest on the political situation in Northern Ireland. Let's speak to Amanda Ferguson, freelance journalist in Northern Ireland, regular on Disunited Kingdom, which we do on Times Radio every Wednesday at 11 o'clock. Morning, Amanda.
Good morning, Matt.
We've also got Bill White, who's a polling expert at Lucid Talks, which carries out opinion polling in Ireland, in Northern Ireland. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Amanda, first of all, explain the background to this. Where are we in terms of the negotiations over the border issue, the border checks, Northern Ireland being treated differently when it comes to custom checks and so on, and the impact that has had on the political conversation in Northern Ireland?
Well, I think it should be made clear, Matt, that the violence that you referenced that took place last year happened for a multitude of reasons.
Yeah.
And sort of the discontent around the Irish Sea border was just one of them. So I think sometimes it will be easy to present that as, you know, there was violence because of the protocol or because of the Brexit protocol, whenever it's a slightly more nuanced than that. But, you know, from whenever I'm talking on your programme, it's always complicated whenever it comes to Northern Ireland. I think that unionism political leaders anyway broadly despise the protocol because they don't view that the Brexit that the UK has achieved is the same in Northern Ireland as it is for GB, and they're unhappy about that. A lot of the discontent amongst unionism is based on perception rather than reality. And if you talk to political parties that are at Stormont, the unionist parties are unhappy with the protocol, whereas the parties who are not unionist parties will say that the protocol mitigates against the worst impacts of Brexit, that Northern Ireland didn't vote for Brexit in the first place, and that there was always going to have to be some unique arrangement for our part of the world because of the unique position that Northern Ireland holds within the United Kingdom and Ireland. So it's definitely, the conversation we're having today is the conversation that all of us in the north of Ireland or Northern Ireland, however you choose to describe this part of the world, pretty much have every single day. It's non-stop discussion about the future status of Northern Ireland, about whether it's going to remain part of the United Kingdom or whether there's going to be a new Ireland created.
Let's bring in Bill on that. What are polls telling us about attitudes toward, you know, within Northern Ireland about, you know, creating a united Ireland, remaining part of the UK? And has there been a change in that over the last sort of months and years?
Well, yes, there has been a change. I mean, there are regular polling now going on before the EU referendum. I mean, it just shows you the change in the narrative. I remember running a poll with the Belfast Telegraph in 2014, and they stuck it on page 2007, it wasn't big news then, and the demand for running Northern Ireland border polls, interestingly, before the 2016 EU referendum, was very, very low, and the number of polls on this issue used to be one poll every 3 or 4 years. Since then, there has been regular polling by ourselves, not least by ourselves, but also by companies like Savanta Comrades, Kantar, Servation, the Liverpool Surveys, the Northern Ireland Life and Times. And actually, last year we ran an average poll of polls just to get a feel for where the situation is. And it's coming in. One of the constants is in all the polling, in 95% to 100% of the polling, is that the pro-Northern Ireland saying in the UK score, the pro-union score, UK union score, is running at about 50%. The other 50%, there's a slight variation in the polls in that Lucid Talk, we have a higher proportion supporting a United Ireland within that 50%. We have it broadly at 50% pro-Northern Ireland staying in the UK, like all the other polls. That's one of the constants in the polling. It's the other 50%, as I've just said, is where the difference comes in. We are around the early 40s pro-United Ireland, and then obviously making up the 100%. That means 10% don't know. Some of the other polls are down towards the 35%, Kantar, Cervantes, Comrades, 15% don't know. But again, they're coming in at the 50% pro-Northern Ireland in the UK. So there's a constant there, but it shows the variation in the other pro-United Ireland side, which is probably not surprising, because let's take into account, people know Northern Ireland. It's in the UK. It's the British culture and still within Northern Ireland, etc. Of course, that's obviously up for dispute in all sorts of other ways. But the United Ireland, what it is, how it would work, that is all a big unknown. So it's not surprising that there is a variation from people who support a United Ireland. And then maybe when they're polled a few months later, they go back into the don't know camp, and then they maybe move towards the United Ireland. They may have an aspiration towards the United Ireland, but a large chunk of people who would be pro that aspiration still would like to know a little bit of more detail about how United Ireland would work. So broadly, the scores are 50% pro-Northern Ireland staying in the UK, 35 to 40% pro-United Ireland, 10 to 15% don't know. That's roughly approximately where the polls are coming in.
And how closely tied is support for remaining in the UK, for instance, tied to how the unionist parties are doing? Because, particularly the DUP have taken a hammering in the polls recently, in part because, they backed Brexit, Northern Ireland didn't back Brexit. Some people have seen that the settlement, the Northern Ireland Protocol, hasn't worked particularly well for Northern Ireland. So sort of their personal, political fortunes. Is there a read across there? In the same way that if Nicola Sturgeon's doing very well in the polls, we tend to see support for independence going up. Is there that link? Is it sort of, if the unionists or the nationalists are doing well, does that shift, or are the two things separate, the minds of people in Northern Ireland?
It's a little bit more separate and a little bit more complex in Northern Ireland. First of all, you've won SNP in Scotland, very strong.
Yeah, of course.
Cohesive party. Northern Ireland, we've split in the unionist camp, the DUP, the Ulster Unionist Party, the UUP, then the increasingly popular TUV, traditional unionist vote. Now, they would all, obviously, their supporters, 99.9% would vote for Northern Ireland to stay in the UK in a Northern Ireland border poll. It's also complicated in that we have a fairly strong middle ground party called the Alliance Party. A border poll could come down how they vote in a border poll, their voters, their supporter base, and how the Green Party supporters and their voter base would vote in a border poll. And we do analyse that as well. And that is splitting maybe 55, 60% pro-Union, 30% pro-United Ireland. So it's, but that varies from poll to poll as well, as people change their minds, etc., about United Ireland and how it would work. So it's more complex than that. It's not linked specifically to the unionist parties. Yeah, yeah. It's more complex than that.
And Amanda Ferguson, is this part of the political debate? We've got Northern Ireland elections coming up this May. Is this part of what politicians are? Clearly, it's an endless part of what they talk about in Scotland. Scotland leaving the UK. Is this part of political conversation? Is there someone really pushing this as a thing?
The insecurity about the future status of Northern Ireland is at the heart of every single political row, every discussion that we see unfolding. Now, my assessment would be that Irish unity would be a matter of when rather than if, and I don't think that it will be something that happens in the immediate short term, but I believe it will happen in the medium to long term, because what we're seeing at the moment is Northern Ireland dividing roughly into thirds. There are three blocks. There are the Irish Republican Nationalists, the British unionists, and then this third bloc, which we describe as other. So that's the cross-community parties who haven't taken a constitutional position, such as the Green Party or the Alliance Party. But just to be extra complicated, their voters will include people who are Republicans or unionists, but who just don't feel the need to vote for a Republican Unionist Party at present.
They're not as tribal, and they might want to vote for the Greens for other reasons, because they think that other things are more important. Really good to speak to you both. That's Amanda Ferguson there, a freelance journalist in Northern Ireland, and who you can often hear on a Wednesday when you do Disunited Kingdom, when we bring you political news from the four corners of the UK. Also really good to speak to Bill White, a polling expert at Lucid Talks. Let's now speak to Kevin Marr, former special advisor to Sean Woodward when he was the Northern Ireland secretary in the Labour government. Kevin's also written a new book, A United Ireland, Why Unification is Inevitable and How It Will Come About. Hi, Kevin.
Morning, Matt.
So, why is unification inevitable, and how will it come about? Without giving away all the spoilers in your book,
the butler did it. It's a combination of factors. I mean, I just look at this kind of from the eastern side of the Irish scene. You just look at the variables, and you just think they're only going to go in one direction: election results, the demographics that are changing in Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland is built in 1921, six counties cleaved out of the historic county of Ulster to provide an inbuilt Protestant unionist majority. That is likely to change in the next census. We may get those figures even in the next month or so. So that's going to be a real inflection point if there is, for the first time in 100 years, a switchover in a majority of people from a Catholic nationalist tradition. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily automatically they're all going to back a United Ireland, but it is emblematic of significant change. As I say, the election results, we've got the assembly elections coming up again in May. If you look at the last set of assembly elections in 2017, and you tot up the votes for parties that broadly support Irish unity and parties that support the union, the gap's about 30,000 votes. I mean, this is nothing really. You know, Sinn Féin was 1,100 votes behind the DUP in 2017. It's likely to top the poll in May, which will send shockwaves through the system. We've seen a role reversal on the island of Ireland, you know, the kind of agrarian, underdeveloped south of Ireland versus the kind of industrial dynamic north of Ireland, which was the kind of characterization at the time of partition. That's been completely reversed. Northern Ireland is a sclerotic economy, very low value, very low productivity. Southern economy, absolutely booming, fastest growing in the EU, 20% growth this year, massive development in things like financial services, technology, pharmaceuticals and what have you. It's one of the most dynamic economies in the world. Northern Ireland would benefit enormously from being part of that settlement. You look at Scottish independence, the kind of the centrifugal forces in the British state, which you know, perhaps people in Northern Ireland are not quite as aware of, the development of kind of English grievances around a lack of levelling up. It's Scottish independence poised again for a second tilt at an independence. You look at Brexit, the impacts of Brexit, the fact that Northern Ireland loses £600 million a year from the European Union in structural funds and farm payments. It's had a massive hit to its growth and GDP as well. And then, of course, we've got the row over the protocol. And underlying all of this, wrapped around all of this, is just the most profound British indifference about Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
We're just not that bothered about it. Every poll shows this. Polls throughout the Troubles showed large sections of the British public just quite happy to see the back of the place. And that's carried on through into the modern age.
I remember sort of successive editors, I have to say, I've been at the Times, but other places have told, you know, when pitching stories, this thing's happening in Northern Ireland, you know, just being told it's boring, nobody cares. I mean, I do think actually partly because the political parties are different. So if you're seeing everything through a political thing, it just feels like another world and you just ignore it.
It's a faraway place of which we know and care little.
Exactly. And it's complicated. So let's not get our heads about it. So we'll sort of move on. Kevin, do you think, from what you're saying, do you think that Scottish independence is a major requirement on the path to Irish reunification?
I think it's going to be very difficult for any British government sat in Westminster to have two major constitutional fires burning at the same time. I think that's going to be very difficult to manage. And it may well be, you know, you look at the state of the Scottish Labour Party, it's, you know, it's stone cold dead. You look at the Scottish Tories, they obviously dropped back support in the last general election. You know, that issue is not going to go away. And I think that there's a lot of wishful thinking that if Nicola Sturgeon was not part of the scene, that the SNP would drop back, and that's just not going to happen. I think there's something that's quite profound. I think this is the kind of parallel a little bit with Brexit, that it's massively invigorating to be at a moment in history where a new state comes into being. And I think that's why a lot of the pocketbook issues that were thrown at Scottish voters back in 2014 just did not have any effect. You know, it just didn't work. And I think we're in that moment where people really pride these moments of national renewal. To put it in a slightly kind of, you know, highfalutin sense. But that will apply, I think, very much in Northern Ireland as well. As this issue continues to gain traction, those kind of don't knows and those people who are persuadable and open to the opportunities that United Ireland might bring, if they're properly articulated, then I think some of those don't knows that Bill was talking about a moment ago will come into the column of backing Irish unity. And it's very much framed by campaigners there as building a new Ireland. It's not a case of just bolting on Northern Ireland into the Republic and that being it. It's about a moment of, again, national renewal for the whole of Ireland.
And I mentioned that you worked for Sean Woodward when he was Secretary of State for Northern Ireland at the end of the Gordon Brown government. How much thought, concern, worry, time did you spend even thinking about the prospect of a united Ireland? What was that? I don't think it was 12 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it was on the agenda, to be honest. I mean, that in those days, it was about getting the final part of the Good Friday Agreement settlement around policing and judicial powers to kind of land. And it was fascinating just at that point, I guess, in 2010. Again, just in Westminster, you know, there's just a massive lack of interest in everything to do with Northern Ireland. There's an assumption that the Good Friday Agreement is signed. Hey, presto, great. That's a great day's work. Crack on and we'll kind of ignore you again. And of course, the Good Friday Agreement is a process, and it is a continual process. And baked into the Good Friday Agreement is a guarantee of a border poll, a referendum on Northern Ireland's constitutional status, if it appears likely to the Secretary of State. This is how it's described in the agreement, that a majority would want to join a united Ireland. So that's why you've got Republicans and nationalists at the table, looking to pursue that as a long-term objective. But we've got to recognise we're nearly 24 years on from the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah.
There's been an attempt in this period to kind of make Northern Ireland work. But I mean, the bald truth of it is Northern Ireland is never going to work. This is the best that Northern Ireland has ever been governed, and it's pretty much a disaster all the time. The devolved bodies have only sat for half the time since the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, but it is still infinitely preferable to everything that went on in Northern Ireland before 30-odd years of the Troubles and 50 years of disgraceful unionist misrule at Stormont for those first 50 years where again, Britain, you know, paid scant regard to what was going on, and questions could not even be asked in the House of Commons about what was going on in Northern Ireland. So dreadful, a dreadful first half century, a dreadful next 30 years, and 20 years where the politics ain't great, but it's infinitely preferable to what's gone on before. And this is as good as it gets in Northern Ireland. So I think there's a lot of people starting to say, when we talk of a new Ireland, this idea of a new Ireland, it can't be any worse than what we've got in Northern Ireland, which is a dysfunctional politics, which is a broken economy, and which is a divided society.
Kevin, stay with us because you might want to chip in with our next two guests. We've got two MPs, one from either side of the debate on this. Ian Paisley Jr., DUP MP for North Antrim. Morning, Ian.
Good morning, Matt.
And we've also got John Finucane, the Sinn Féin MP for North Belfast. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Ian Paisley Jr., I've been listening to the conversation we've been having. Is, from your perspective, as a unit representing a unionist party, is a united Ireland inevitable?
Well, good morning. Good morning to your guests, Matt. No, a united Ireland isn't inevitable, but I'm not complacent about the challenges that face this region. I'm very interested in Kevin's analysis. I think it's very surprising. He presents an English nationalist analysis. His arguments are Anglified, sectarian, snobbery against the regions. I'd say that if he was asked to write the same thing about Scotland, he would do the same thing. If he was asked to write even the same thing about Wales or even parts of the North, he'd probably do the same thing and take the same sort of attitude, that this kind of London-centric, Anglified view of life, and therefore everyone else doesn't matter. I mean, we see it from one perspective. Of course, the United Kingdom and Britishness is made up of a much more eclectic view, and a view which I'm not British because an Englishman allows me to be British and passes that down to me. I'm British as of right, and because I have self-determined to be British. And I think that that's something which maybe Kevin's mind hasn't been able to actually get around. And I also think that the economic analysis, which he went over briefly, appears to be rather superficial and inadequate. And if you could make a very serious point, and if you could give me just the room to do it, because people may not like unionists per se, and they may at elections vote and split their vote with regards to unionists. But when it comes to the union collects a much wider collective beyond what the unionist parties reach because of the economic and indeed sometimes emotional or a mixture of both of what that means. So what does it mean in stark economic terms? First of all, Northern Ireland is part of the fifth largest economy of the world. It is a tax and subvention public sector based economy which delivers less than 5% unemployment to the people. And as a result, the standard of living, according to Cambridge University analysis, is 20% higher than the rest of the United Kingdom. And just yesterday, the leader of the SDLP said that his own mother would have problems voting for United Ireland because of the NHS and the welfare state, something which is completely absent in the Ireland. But I just make the other side of the coin, and sorry, Matthew, I really do appreciate you giving me the time because I think it will help the actual debate. Because in the Republic of Ireland, the levels of unemployment are approaching 20%. It is the poorest region of the British Isles. It was the poorest region of the British Isles when it left the United Kingdom 100 years ago. And after 100 years of independence and 45 years of membership of the EU, it remains the poorest region of the British Isles with 20% higher costs of living. It also indicates very strongly to me the very obvious question. If you have a tax haven economy compared to an economy which is part of the United Kingdom's economy, uniting those two economies is almost impossible.
OK, Ian, make sure my other guests get a chance to come in. Kevin, briefly, do you want to respond to Ian's criticism of your analysis? And I'll bring John in.
I mean, I don't know where to begin, but I'll be very, very brief. I'm not taking any lectures about sectarianism from a man like Ian Paisley and his father. Let me just say that for a start. Ireland's got the Republic of Ireland's got the second highest living standards in the world, according to the United Nations. It's got the fastest growing economy in the European Union at 20% this year. This kind of snooty unionist view that Southern Ireland is kind of some agrarian kind of backwater is so off the pace, it's untrue.
Thank you, Kevin. Let's go to John. John Van Oeken, Sinn Féin MP. Do you think that unification is inevitable?
Well, I must start by challenging some of the figures that were trotted out by Ian Paisley there. They quite simply aren't true. And before I answer your question, I think that the economic argument is a very important one because people... I think you asked some of the contributors earlier on how much this dominates politics and the day-to-day issues in the North. People look at our health service. People look at how much disposable income they have. They look at the disparity in wages between the North and the South. And what runs through all of that as a constant is people looking to the future and having an ambition for a better future. And when you see the likes of public sector workers, if you're in the police or a teacher, earning £10,000 less or having less of a disposable income, we have some of the highest levels of credit card and other forms of debt in these islands and some of the worst rates of children's poverty. I think people are rightfully looking to the future. And there are those in either side who will say that no matter what, they will wish to remain part of the union or that they will wish to have a united Ireland. But there are those, as a result of triggers like Brexit, who are looking to the future and who may previously not have thought about the constitutional future for themselves and their families, are now seriously asking the question, what would this mean for me? And I think the space that we are in at the minute is that we need to have a debate that is informed, that is fact-checked, and that is responsible. And I think that Brexit has shown us, this is trotted out quite a lot, but it's true, it's shown us how not to do things. And it's why we in Sinn Féin believe that change on the island is inevitable. But what is possibly more important is that we must manage that. And it's how we get to that point, which is key, because this will be a new Ireland. It's not necessarily having to be at each other's throats or rubbing out a line on a map, which has been disastrous for the island. It is about having the conversation and being informed so that people are very clear about what it is they're voting for and what it is they're voting against when the time comes to have that referendum. Because, and I'll finish with this very briefly, because the way in which this is achieved has been set out in the Good Friday Agreement. And there's a slightly ambiguous test that will have to be applied by a Secretary of State. And it's if it appears to him or her that the majority of people want unity, then a poll must be called. So what are these triggers? What are the indicators? Kevin has already referenced the census results that are coming out. Even in the last Westminster election, for the first time in the history of the North jurisdiction, the majority of MPs returned to Westminster support a united Ireland. So there are multiple indicators all around us. And I think there's a responsibility, not just on parties, but particularly the Irish government as well, that they need to now bring this conversation to the next level and have it, I think, attach resources to that as well.
Just fine. I want to come back to you, Ian Paisley, because you mentioned you were trying to sort of draw the distinction between the day-to-day support for unionist parties and overall support for unionism. Are you concerned that the DUP support for Brexit, which has led to problems for Northern Ireland, has led to a drop, actually, in support for the DUP? I mean, the most recent, we had Bill from Lucid Talks on, most recent one, the DUP were down to 18% in the polls, having been on 28% back in 2017. Geoffrey Donaldson, your leader, 66% of people thought he was bad or awful. Are you concerned that the political underperformance of your party and your leader, Geoffrey Donaldson, is actually helping to pave the way towards a united Ireland?
No, I don't. And as I said, I think the fluctuations of the support for individual political parties, and remember, unionism is divided into a multifarious of at least three parties and a number of independents. But on the big question of the union, there is unity on the opposition to the protocol, for example. There is unity. I know that's not the debate we want to go down, but we're focusing on the issue of the economy. And Kevin can't get away from this. You know, the difference between being part of the fifth largest economy in the world and being part of, the 35th largest economy in the world is miles apart. It's significant. The issue, he says, that some sort of advocate of view of the Republic of Ireland, which is backward and rural, and probably in the Republic of Ireland far more than Kevin is. And I know very well the economy. But according to the Cambridge analysis that was produced a matter of months ago, and last time I checked, that was written in England by an English person, Cambridge analysis indicated that it's 20% higher cost of living.
Okay, but I feel like we're slightly going around in circles there. We're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. As ever, this is a debate which will run and run. That was Ian Paisley Jr., the DUP MP for North Antrim. We also heard from John Funakin, the Sinn Féin MP for North Belfast. Kevin Marr is the author of A United Ireland, Why Unification is Inevitable and How It Will Come About. We've had quite a mixed bag of response to that. Some people saying great debate, a brilliant debate around a united Ireland. Well worth a listen, says Stuart. And Henry says, three terrible people on the show. make of that one. Let's have a debate about the quality of the debate. One of the points that several of you have made is what does the Republic of Ireland actually make of this? There's a limited number of people we can have on in half an hour, and it's something we'll return to. I think definitely those census figures that Kevin was talking about. It's definitely worth having a look at. But we thought it was an interesting issue, given all the debate about the Northern Ireland Protocol and so on. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.